Hey everybody, it's George. Just a quick note before we get started. Yesterday, we released the issue 10 cover. Issue 10, it feels like a huge milestone. We've made it this far. It's really, I don't know, it feels like an accomplishment. At the same time, it feels like we're just getting started. We're just in the middle of the third subscriber cycle. And, we're constantly trying to grow our audience, get more people to read Howler. And I know that we have a lot more people who listen to this podcast than read Howler. And if just a fraction of you guys gave it a chance, if you subscribed, if you have $50 laying around and want to go take a chance on what I promise is a very good soccer magazine that has a lot of smart and creative people working on it, I would appreciate it. You go to shop.howlermagazine.com, take a look at the cover. If you like it, give it a shot. It's a worthwhile investment. The cover is really fun. It's a take on an old Titian painting. It's called Bacchus and Ariadne, and it's got these like old, you know, classical figures in these flowing robes. And of course we replaced Bacchus with Diego Maradona, you know, doing the hand of God, and you know, just a couple of other famous tens you recognize: Zidane and Puskas and Carly Lloyd and Pele and Messi, of course. And it's a lot of fun, and it's sort of, you know, it's a little bit of a statement of the way we like to blend, you know, some highbrow writing with fun soccer images. So please take a look, shop.howlermagazine.com. It's issue 10. I'm very proud of this. There are a lot of good people who work on Howler, and I just want to keep the magazine going strong. So please go give it a shot, shop.howlermagazine.com. Thanks. Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Crazy. I'm the editor of Howler. I'm joined by the only member of this podcast to have scored a goal in any professional league in Scandinavia, although Christian Hennage, the other member of this podcast today, has seen him score a goal. I guess I blew the intro there. Christian and Bobby Warshaw. Hey, guys. Welcome to Dummy.
What's up, George?
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Yes, of course. So, okay, this week on Dummy, we have, David, we thought we were going to David, but his schedule is a little bit off. So we have the next best thing. Kristen, I hope you don't mind. You know, you've been polishing David's boots for a while now, and I think it's time for you to step up to the big league and join us for Dummy again. I'm going to speak with a very, very interesting person. Her name is Khalida Popal, and she is a former member of the Afghan women's national team who is currently living in asylum, I think that's the right term, in Denmark. And man, she just has such an interesting story. So we're going to talk to her a little bit later. First, Kristen, Bobby, and I are going to discuss, well, we've got Leicester, top of the Premier League right now. We'll see how long that lasts. But the last time a not huge club won the Premier League, the only time a team that isn't named Manchester City, Manchester United, Arsenal, or Chelsea won the Premier League, it was Blackburn Rovers, 1995. We're going to discuss. Okay, Kristen, I'm going to throw it to you. You have an English accent, which means you know all about English soccer. What happened in 1995? This, like, I was not paying attention to English soccer at this point, and I've read about it on Wikipedia. Lay it on us.
Well, I was frantically trying to memorize the names of the Blackburn team in my sticker book because it was a bit of a surprise that they achieved this. I think what I would say is, first and foremost, is that essentially the Premier League was still in its infancy. So we were kind of adjusting to this new situation and the TV and all the things that came with it, those kind of trappings. And you could argue that Blackburn propelled that vision of the Premier League being one of the elite, I think, in the modern era at least. But they did do it with a little bit of help from Jack Walker, who funded things.
Kristen, can I stop you actually and ask, at its most basic question, what was different about the Premier League compared to whatever it was before? I mean, wasn't it just the same league?
That would be part of it. It wasn't as pretty as it is now, I think. There's definitely a point, and I personally stop it at when Rude Hullett and Gianluca Vialli arrive, mid-90s, that's when you see something of a continental and a cultural shift in the Premier League. You see this almost maturation process of the whole thing. Because prior to that...
You meant to include Jurgen Klinsmann in that too, I think.
Yes, Jurgen was vital as well in doing that. We chronically underplay his influence.
It's a matter of money, right? I mean, the teams in the top sort of they were up in the first division that year, and they sort of just pulled the ladder up behind them and just made it. Basically, kept the money from the, you know, they were able to sell the rights to the TV companies and not share it as equitably as they had in the past. Would you sum it up that way, Kristen?
I would say that's fair. I would say as well, the idea was that you were polishing things as well. Look at the kind of iconography of the Premier League very early on. It's like a lion. It's this idea of look at this grandiose, brilliant gladiatorial kind of competition that we now have, the Premier League with its great big trophy with a crown on top of it. There was definitely kind of a lot of delusions of grandeur, I think, with the early days of the Premier League that propelled it to its situation.
Yeah. This reminds me of something we have in the upcoming issue of Howler. It's a photo essay by this guy named Stuart Roy Clark, and it's called Pre-Prem. It's English soccer in the 1990s before the Premier League. So, you know, basically 1990-91, part of 1992. And it is such a charming look at basically working class England, and it looks nothing like what you imagine, you know, the Emirates Stadium would look like today. But you know, you have these guys who look like they've just stumbled out of the pub. They're mooning the camera, they're getting patted down by these quaint looking bobbies, they are walking along these like footpaths in the dirt up down to like the Leeds, whatever Leeds Stadium is called, I forget what it's called, you know. And it's just a really gorgeous, beautiful time that was probably terrible to live through, but just looks really, really, yeah, I'm just so nostalgic for this period I never lived through when I look at these pictures.
Oh, that's massive. It is. And I mean, I talk about the the sticker album, the trophy sticker, which I believe was number two. I think number one was the Premier League logo. Those were kind of the two that you coveted most and you kind of liked it. Again, simple childlike minds. Those were always the really hard ones to get and the ones that you were quite delighted when you got. So you could argue perhaps on a subliminal level, they were quite smart in pushing this image of the Premier League being the elite and being this great invention for football in England.
Why did they change in the first place? Where did the name come from? Why was there a change from this English First Division?
Hang on. I do think this is important to talk about. I want to save it for another episode, probably, Bobby. We're gonna get pretty far down the rabbit hole when I want to talk about Blackburn here. And I want to throw it to you, Bobby. But first, just to show how crazy it would be for Leicester to win the league this year, I just want to read every champion of the Premier League since it began in 1992-93. Okay, 93, Manchester United. 94, Manchester United. 95, Blackburn Rovers. 96, United. 97, United. 98, Arsenal. 99, United. 2000, United. 2001, United. 2002, Arsenal. 2003, United. 2004, Arsenal. 05, Chelsea. 06, Chelsea. 07, United. 08, United. 09, United. 2010, Chelsea. 11, United. 2012, Manchester City wins its first. 13, United. 14, City. 15, of course, Chelsea. And now it looks like either Leicester, Arsenal, or Spurs could win. And the only, you know, if Arsenal wins, it'll be back to, you know, what they call the Big Four. And if the other two win, it will be another first. You know, and Kristen, before we jump to, I know I said I'd throw it to you, Bobby, but before we get to that, I will point out the one big name I would say that's missing from this list is Liverpool.
Yeah, wow, that's a good point. I think
just made a lot of listeners really angry. There's a lot of Liverpool people out there that are going to hate you now, George.
I mean, it's just a fact. I mean, it's unfortunate, I guess, for Liverpool, but it's interesting that they are considered. I think they've been considered one of those teams, and they won the Champions League a couple times in this period, but they still haven't won the Premier League as such.
True, and I think if you look at when they came closest a few years ago, kind of how much it meant to them in terms of laying a demon to rest. There was so much outside of just collecting the league. It was the idea of Sir Alex Ferguson saying he wanted to knock them off their expletive perch, and he really did do that.
You can say, what did he say? Give us
We're
the
cool, yeah. We're cool here on the Dummy Podcast.
He said, I want to knock them off their fucking perch.
Ah, okay.
I went to a Catholic school. I'm used to swearing in front of authority figures.
I'm sorry, in front of strangers. Yeah, so Bobby, you did some research for this podcast. Not that you don't do research for other episodes, but what did you learn about how Blackburn won this title?
So there's two frames of mind. There's one that Jack Walker bought their way to the trophy, which is somewhat true. They broke the record for a goalkeeper at the time. They broke the record for English players. There's also a thought that they actually didn't do that. That, yeah, they spent a little money, but way less, both on wages and incoming players, than the other big clubs did. That Manchester United still outspent them in the transfer window, and it was actually some really clever signings with guys like Tim Sherwood to give them this English feel and this camaraderie and this unison. So they spent money, which you always have to do, but it wasn't nearly as much as people remember. It wasn't over the top as some of the teams do now.
I assume you know the Tim Sherwood story as well, the one about Zidane.
No, please tell.
So when Zinedine Zidane, I believe it was at Bordeaux, he was kind of shopped around, and Blackburn were given the opportunity to sign him, I believe after they'd won the league. And I believe, was it Jack Walker? Yeah, I believe it was either Jack Walker or Kenny Dalglish said, "Why do I need Zinedine Zidane? I've got Tim Sherwood."
Ooh, that is awesome.
What a great quote.
Well, it's a good question. We could get into this too. I mean, could Zinedine Zidane have done it in 1995 in the Premier League? You know, could Zinedine Zidane have done it on a cold, wet Tuesday in Stoke?
It would have happened.
Bobby,
you're
about to get kicked off this podcast.
I know. Sorry, another foray for another day.
But, yeah. Okay. So, you know, Kristen, take us through who they did have. They had Alan Shearer, who was the leading scorer that year in the Premier League. So, who was his sort of supporting cast, if you will?
Well, he himself was a behemoth. I think you can easily say. Chris Sutton was a big one who had come, I believe, he's come from Norwich. He was again a highly thought of striker. I think he cost about $5 million at the time. You had Colin Hendry, who, funnily enough, I met on holiday around the time that he won the league. You had Graham Lassow, David Batty. These were high-level players. I think the truth lies in between the two theories that Bobby put forth there, in terms of they did spend at the level of an elite club, but they also spent well, because we've seen enough clubs, I think, throughout the annals of time, that have spent money and still managed to find a way to mess things up. So it's not a guaranteed signs that if you invest heavily, you win a league. So you have to give them credit for that. I think the lack of longevity, though, points to the idea that maybe they didn't have so much of a plan as a checkbook with a few pages in it.
Was it a down year for the rest of the Premier League? When we talk about Leicester, one of the reasons they're doing so well is because it's not that the other four teams, the other four or five major clubs, aren't as good.
I see what you mean. I think, to be fair, Liverpool were going through a somewhat difficult time adjusting to the next generation. I don't think there was as many competitors for them. Arsenal, if I remember right, were having similar struggles. They weren't at the level. There perhaps wasn't as much competition. The playing field was slightly even across the board. But again, I think you have to give them credit, because they managed to maintain it for what was a very long season back then. It wasn't the 38 games that it is now. I think it's 42 it was back then.
God, I can't even imagine that.
It was a genuine kind of war of attrition between them and their rivals, because they had to maintain it for so long and did so, I would say, quite admirably. It fell off a little bit afterwards. There was the famous fight between David Batty and Graham Lassow in Europe that normally gets trotted out on English television when there's one of these compilation shows, that was quite funny, because I think Graham Lassow in a fight is just quite a funny image. But overall, it was a beautiful time for Blackburn, and unfortunately, one that they just couldn't recapture.
Well, you know what seems to be the big thing about Leicester right now is they just really overhit on three players. Well, maybe two and a half. Vardy was always known to have talent of a top club, right? You would know more about this than we would. But he was always known to be a fantastic player, just apparently a horrible dude. A player that nobody wanted to take on. And then with Conte and Mahrez, they just got really lucky. Or their scouting system was really good. I mean, it so happened that they bought three players at lower prices that anybody else in the world would have been lucky to have, but Leicester happened to find them, happened to bid, and just kind of got a little lucky with how good they turned out to be.
Well, Mahrez is a really funny one, because I was actually privy to the story that the scout that Leicester sent was not meant to be watching Riyad Mahrez. He was meant to be watching a totally different player. And he rocked up at the game, and Mahrez caught his eye, and he kind of went back and said, "Look, I found this young winger, I think he would be good." But again, the idea that he was some hidden gem or whatever, there really wasn't a vast amount of people talking about him. Le Havre, as a club, has a very strong history of producing talent. You look at Paul Pogba, Lassana Diarra, there are names that have walked out of that academy that have gone on to great things. I wouldn't say Riyad Mahrez was projected the same thing. What I would say about him is he's incredibly mature and incredibly smart with his career, because he had the chance to join Marseille or PSG when he was a lot younger, and he turned it down on the idea that I'm just not going to play football. Whereas if I go to Le Havre, I'll play football, I'll continue developing. And I think to show that kind of maturity when, realistically, he probably had a much better financial offer from those two clubs, I think shows a lot of maturity in a young man.
Man, we could write a book on the number of guys who got ahead of themselves thinking that they would play or thinking their career would take off, and they sit the bench, you never hear from them again.
Is that, though, and you can answer this much better than anyone else, Bobby, is that because you spend most of your life being told you're very good, you're brilliant, you're better than everyone else, and I imagine even the club that talks to you says, look, we think you're great, you should come here. Is it hard to have self-awareness and perspective when someone's telling you that?
Oh, yeah, this is going to be my tiki talker for today. To be a good player, you've got to be totally self-delusional. It's almost a catch-22. To be a great player, you've got to have horrible personality traits. So the second somebody tells you that, for you to be grounded, I can't even imagine it. I don't know how these guys are fantastic players and have any accurate sense of self-awareness or self-ability.
All right, guys, I'm going to bring some self-awareness back to this podcast and let you know that we have to get back on track to Blackburn Rovers. I really want to talk about Blackburn Rovers. Okay, so there are some interesting things about their season, okay? First of all, they hadn't won a title, Wikipedia tells me, in 67 years, which is kind of insane that they would go and win, you know, during, you know, what has become the most, I guess, the most competitive or at least the richest era of English soccer. Also, Kenny Dalglish was the manager. I didn't realize this. You know, he's obviously a Liverpool legend, and he retired from managing at the end of that season. Of course, he came back to sign Andy Carroll later for Liverpool, which, you know, whether that was an act of revenge for something we don't know about it or not, we will never know. Sorry, Christian, I know you're a Newcastle fan. and also they won the league, Blackburn did, on the final day of the season despite losing to Liverpool, because Manchester United, which finished a point below them in the standings, 88 points to 89, lost to West Ham, drew at West Ham 1-1, and so they could have overtaken them, but they didn't. So anyway, those are some little tidbits from the season. I guess the big question is, you know, the differences between this Leicester side and Blackburn, which we've talked about a little bit, but, you know, we've had title challenges in the past from lesser sort of teams with lower payrolls and things like that. What's always ended up happening is they either fizzle out, they don't have sort of the squad depth to go all the way, or they'll lose some of their good players in the transfer window. Even if Leicester hangs on and does win the league this year, it's likely that guys like Mahrez and Vardy will go in the offseason, don't you think?
Definitely. I mean, Barcelona want Mahrez already. That's kind of been accepted as a truth now. And that, in fact, he's a higher priority than Royce.
Marco. But wait, has he kissed the badge? Do we know if he's kissed the badge? Because then he can't leave.
Well, that is usually the kiss of death, to pardon the pun. I think what you could say is Vardy is perhaps slightly more likely to stay because he is a little bit older. I think people sometimes forget that with Jamie Vardy, he's a little bit older. And I was quite fortunate to do a piece for Yahoo this season where I went and talked to all the people that he worked with in Sunder League at Stocksbridge Park Steels. And I found it really funny that all of them said, his game hasn't changed a bit since he was with us. And I found that perhaps they were kind of, you know, pulling my leg or kind of just trying to tell a good story. But then I kind of saw some footage of him and it really hasn't. He's exactly the same player that he is now with Leicester. And it arguably, I would say, puts towards the idea that part of the reason this Leicester team are doing so well is because they have an Italian coach who is exceptionally well organised, exceptionally well drilled, and is giving them a structure that I think we've lost a little bit in the Premier League over the last few years. We've become
absolutely
a little bit more of an open league. And I seem to remember reading a stat once that said the Premier League had the most goals from individual errors in the top five in Europe. And to me, that points to the idea that actually we're not the most tactically complicated as a nation. And you could even further the idea and say that plays itself out when we get on the international stage as a national team, because we can't break down a side like Italy. We can't even.
And in Champions League.
Exactly. That's another instance where you see that maybe towards the back end of the last decade, when English teams dominated, it was because they were just so full power, energy, pedal to the metal, they just overran teams. But obviously,
yeah, but Bobby, how often is an English Champions League squad actually playing English players with an English coach? Not very often.
It's a good point. But still, you're so used to playing one style week in and week out that it's hard to turn on. It's hard to get mentally focused for those little tactical details.
Mm-hmm. One other aspect of this is sort of squad value, wages, you know, and Stefan Szymanski and Simon Cooper have shown in Soccernomics, or they argue that, you know, you can sort of predict how well a team's going to do based on how much it pays its players. Not because, you know, if you pay someone more, they'll play better, but because they, you know, it's sort of a reflection of the quality of the squad, right? And so I guess the question, Bobby, for you is, do you think that players, you know, it's a pretty open market, people can see what players can do, you know, transferring happens all the time. Do you think that the best players tend to rise to the best teams and get higher and higher paychecks? Or, you know, I guess the answer is yes, obviously. But is this something you can sort of see? Is it tangible on the field when you play with some of these guys?
It's a good question. I don't think we think about it enough, is that human beings innately want value in themselves. And for better or for worse, the way we measure that, there's two ways, right? There's your FIFA rating, which is a little bit of a, you know, players don't actually notice that. But it's also your wage. The way to show a player's value, when you go into a contract negotiation with your coach and your technical director of your team, and they put a number in front of you, you don't necessarily think in terms of hot dogs and dinners and vacations for your family. You think in terms of overall value to that club. So in a world market, the way that you can become more valuable, the way that you feel like you can achieve, is moving up clubs and getting paid higher wages. So yeah, the better players are also prideful guys, so the higher wages they can get at bigger clubs is really what separates it.
Do you know what your teammates make? I know in MLS you do because they release it to the players' union, but in Europe, do you guys talk about it with each other?
Usually you're close. Yes, by the end of the season, it gets out. One guy tells another guy. He tells his two or three best friends on the team. Usually by the end, you have a fair assessment of what everyone in the locker room makes.
I've heard English players really complain about that, actually. Luke Rogers was one.
Really?
He said that the fact that MLS was transparent with the wages was a real pain in the backside. Because on the one hand, it meant that everyone knew what he was on everywhere. He said it also meant that everyone in the locker room knew what everyone else was on. And say you've got a guy, let's take Rafa Márquez, someone he played with, who's on an exorbitant amount of money and not pulling his weight. And then you've got someone like Luke, who I think was on about 200,000 every season. It can easily breed contempt amongst colleagues because, you know, if you're not pulling your weight and you're not justifying that huge salary, everyone knows what you're on because the league publishes it.
Chris, it's funny. We used to joke as the lower salary guys on the team would go out after a game. You shouldn't expect people to ever pay for you, but yeah, you know, there's a general assessment that the guys making $200,000-$300,000 should buy a beer, you know, buy a dinner every now and then for the guys on $35,000 or $40,000.
Well, that's what happened with Beckham and Galaxy, didn't it? He kind of annoyed everyone because he didn't, and particularly Landon Donovan, because he didn't pay the tab at a steak dinner or something like that.
Yep. Landon's a bred American who came to the league and understand these little mores within the players. I know that conversation killed you, George.
No.
I don't see that happening with Leicester, for what it's worth. Because, again, a lot of their players, N'Golo Kante is a great example. Wenger talks about him very positively and says, you know, I knew exactly about him. I'd watched him since he was 10 or 11. And I didn't think he was ready for the Premier League. I can't imagine he's on a huge amount of money. The same with Jamie Vardy, Riyad Mahrez. There's no one in that squad that I look at and think, I bet he's on a good whack to have come to Leicester. Cambiasso last season, perhaps. But obviously he's left and departed to new pastures.
If I can make a comment about Leicester, it seems that there's a little, they're a funny point where they're better than the teams below them. They have enough talent, enough ability to beat the teams that are worse than them in the table, which is how they get points there. But then they have the perfect tactical approach to beat the teams above them. They sit deep, they counter, and they've got just enough of talent to pull it out. So like this little precipice, this little right on top of the fence of talent to be good enough in the teams above them, but not good enough to fully challenge the top teams, but instead take a tactical approach, but have enough talent with that tactical approach.
I'm so totally lost.
You don't often see that.
No. Okay. I want to wrap this up pretty soon. I have. I'm surrendering to the fact that we're not going to really talk about Blackburn. That's okay. I think this was interesting. It went in good places. And I'm just excited. I think. Kristen, I'd like you to do a little bit of research, please. Check the betting markets. I want to see what the odds are of Mahrez going to Barcelona and then Leicester beating Barcelona in the Champions League final next season. If you would.
I know my brother stands to collect a few hundred pounds if Leicester win, because he put a bet on it. I think it was 33 or 34 to 1 for them to win the league.
Oof. When was that? Like early on? I mean, that wasn't
relatively early on. I think he took the risk, so to speak. But that'll be the interesting thing with Leicester as well, is that if you look at Blackburn, they did kind of drop like a stone after that. They finished 7th the season after, I think 13th the year after that. Then they peaked up back to 6th, and before you knew it, they were relegated under Roy Hodgson, if I remember correctly. So again, it's that idea of maybe the sophomore slump, as you guys say over there. How do they react after everyone's sat and watched them for a year and said, okay, well, they like to do this, how do we stop this?
Okay. All right, guys, let's leave it there. And when we come back, I will be speaking with a member of the Afghan Women's National Team. It's a great interview. I encourage you to stick around.
Hello, this is Daryl
and Taylor
from the Total Soccer Show.
If you're already listening to Dummy, then you must be a smart, savvy soccer fan with excellent taste in audio.
But you should still give the Total Soccer Show a listen anyway.
Our show is a bit of everything. We've got complex breakdowns of the latest U.S. national team performances, coverage of the Premier League, the Champions League, and MLS.
We also cover up-and-coming U.S. prospects.
Shout out to Christian Pulisic.
We draft fantasy soccer rosters, the latest composed entirely of Simpsons characters.
Yeah, buddy.
And we partake in some heated trivia battles.
So give us a listen. We put out a new show 3 times a week.
You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
That's the Total Soccer Show for all your non-dummy podcast needs.
Now back to Jordan.
We've all heard stories of people who are in some way oppressed, finding hope and maybe even salvation through the game of soccer. But among those remarkable stories, the one that Khalida Popal tells manages to stand out. A founding member of the Afghanistan women's national team, she fought for the right for women to play soccer and eventually fled the country when her life was threatened. She was granted asylum in Denmark, and that's where she joins me from today. Khalida, welcome to Dummy. I wonder if you can tell me the story about why you had to leave your home, your family, and your teammates behind in Afghanistan.
Thank you so much. I have left my country in 2011. And I used to be the leader of women's football in Afghanistan and the first lady who made the history in Afghanistan Football Federation and also in football, that I started as a first player of Afghanistan national team and also the first woman who has... who was leading the women's national team and women's football in Afghanistan. And that's why, as you know, that in Afghanistan, there are so many groups that they are against women's activities, and there are Afghanistan is one of the male-dominated country. So there are so many groups that they don't want women to be active and participate actively in the society. And those women who are standing and doing activities for women and for women rights, they face a lot of problems and life threats. And I was one of those that I faced so many life threats, and it got worse, so I had to leave my country.
So you're saying that people were threatening to kill you because you wanted to play soccer?
Yes, it was because I wanted to play soccer, and also at the same time I was encouraging women to be active in the society and take part, active part in the society.
Your story is specifically about soccer, but you were trying to bring women into mainstream society in Afghanistan, and I get the impression that if soccer hadn't been the avenue you chose, there would have been something else to be that vehicle.
Well, in Afghanistan, football is a national game, and football is known as a man's game. So I choose football because it was for me, it was a very strong tool to stand for my right and to stand for equality and say that, okay, if a man can play football, why not women? If a man have a right to play football in a country like Afghanistan, why not women? And there we start playing football and use that as a football as a tool to stand for our right.
How were you introduced to football?
I was It was 2004, and I was 16 years old that I started playing football.
How did you learn about it? Was it by seeing some men playing?
My mother was my school teacher, and we had this basketball team and volleyball team, but I wasn't that interested in that because it was saying, like, in my country, basketball and volleyball is known for women game. So I was actually not interested in that. And when it comes to the football that my brothers actually was playing, and I was playing with my brothers as amateur in the street or at in the garden of our house. So,
why do you think that basketball and volleyball were acceptable for women, but football wasn't?
Football is known as a very strong and powerful game, which, like, masculine game, it's a man's game, not women's game.
Oh, interesting. So the reason we're speaking today is because the sportswear company Hummel has released a new uniform for the Afghan women's national team that you had a hand in creating. Can you tell me about some of the special features that contains?
Yes, actually the new jersey and the new uniform, which is launched yesterday, it's so much telling about the history and story of Afghanistan. It's so much with the story of, for example, example is that they have printed the loin in the jersey or the T-shirt, which is our national teams or football teams are known as the loins of Afghanistan. And the heritage and the other materials that it's used in the T-shirt is it's so much selling about our traditional clothes and national clothes, and especially hijab, which is made for our national team of women's. It's actually first time a company, I think, so far the first company that has made hijab for a football team. Which was needed, actually.
That's interesting. So there's a head cover actually built into the fabric of the jersey.
It's in base layer, I would say.
Oh, okay.
Because in Afghanistan, people are more focused on the hijab, and it's because it's a part of culture and part of religion that the women should cover the head. So actually, for most of our players, were a barrier. Since they were playing football and they didn't have material to cover their head, and for example, they were wearing a scarf which was not comfortable to play with, and then the girls were really really in need of that kind of material or kind of hijab that also it go through and the barrier, and also make an opportunity for other girls to come and join football if wearing hijab helps them to come and play football. So why not?
So we recently saw a video of the Iranian women's national futsal team playing in hijab, and they were just incredibly skillful. They scored a wonderful goal that had all these, you know, little small quick touches and just great bursts of skill. And what was striking to me is that it seemed a little bit like a paradox. You know, you see these women playing in hijab, and yet when we watch some of the best players in the world, they seem to want to rebel against the uniform they have on. They're wearing colorful shoes and you know, have sort of attention seeking haircuts, and they want to sort of exert their individuality. I'm wondering if there's a tension that you see between wearing something like that that sort of conceals your identity in a sense, it conceals part of your body, and yet needing to express yourself on the field. Is that something that you've thought about?
I mean, I would say if I will talk about Afghanistan, specifically about Afghanistan or Iran, it's for covering the head, it gives an opportunity, and also women feel safe while playing in Afghanistan or Iran, because the society are focused on that. So I mean, if the women doesn't wear hijab, so the family and the society will not allow them to come in and play football. So they lose that opportunity.
It's difficult for me to imagine some of the challenges you and your teammates have gone through just in terms of trying to get together and have a practice or kick the ball around. Can you describe some of those challenges and what you guys went through just to be able to play?
In the beginning, it was very, very difficult because people were, and society was not used to see women playing football, and especially doing football activities or sport activities. So they were against our activities, and some of them, they were trying to stop us for playing football. Some people were, some group of people who were against our activities were jumping in our football field, and they were taking the footballs and they were insulting our the teammates, and there were so many street harassment.
Oh, man. Were these mostly men, Khalida, or did you find that some women were also opposed to you playing football?
It was mostly men, but I would say that also there was also women who were against football activity, our football activity, because I remember most of my teachers were that they were women and they were against my activity, and they, so many times I was kicked out of class because I was playing football and I was doing activity which was not acceptable for them. So in 2004 and 2005. They were calling our team like prostitutes. Those, which is a very harsh word, but actually they call it, and we face so many problems. But it's getting better and better, and now it's the team is developing, and the football is women's football is developing in Afghanistan, which is really giving hope for the future.
Khalida, I apologize for bringing up a difficult, an extra difficult period of your story, but I think it's very powerful. You, at one point, it got so bad for you that you decided to try to take your own life. Can you tell me about what led up to that and how it resolved?
In 2011, I would say that when I became the leader of women's football, and I was feeling much more stronger, and my voice was getting stronger and stronger, and I was more talking on public and media, and I was encouraging more women to come and play football and do sport activities, and we wanted to bring the tradition of sport in our country, or especially in Kabul. That most of men were against my activities, because I was, it was a feeling that I had that most of the men, even they were educated and they were powerful guys in the government, but they were feeling like losing their power against a woman. So that's what they don't want, to lose their power for a woman. And when it comes like in the point that they feel this losing the power, they do whatever it costs. So killing in Afghanistan, killing a woman in Afghanistan, or raping a woman in Afghanistan is just so easy, because government is not very supportive. The security is not very supportive towards women and women activities. This is, we don't have support from
protection. Right,
yes, the protection from our government or from our the security officers, like in Afghanistan. So that's why it's easier to shut a woman there.
And so you were facing extreme opposition to what was, it seems to me, a relatively simple message that women should be able to partake in an activity like football.
And they were like, it was much more rumors and blame that I was against my culture and against my my religion, and I'm supporting women to stand against the culture, and kind of they were feeling that I will bring the Western culture in Afghanistan, which was not true. So this is something that they start talking about against me, and it got worse.
So you've been living in Denmark now for, I believe, 5 years, going on 5 years. And, you know, of course, Danish society has its own sort of complicated relationship with I guess, Islam. You know, the newspaper there published some cartoons that of Muhammad that set off some violent protests. What have you learned in your time living in Denmark about Danish society and culture?
First of all, I want to say that it's 3 years that I'm living in Denmark, and what surprised me in the beginning when I came to Denmark was a freedom that everybody had the freedom to talk whatever they want to, till the time it was not insulting someone else, and the women who had the power to stand and say no and say yes or give an opinion about something that they think it's wrong. So it's so much freedom. Like I felt as a woman, I felt like I can develop very fast, and I have support from governments, from people, from all people around me, because they don't they are encouraging me, and they are not against my ideas. If I say it, good ideas, of course they will accept, or at least they have, they will say yes or no, or they will not treat me like I will kill you, or if you don't stop, I will shoot you. It's something that I don't face it here.
So you're still very much of the age where you could be playing for the Afghan women's national team. And so I imagine having designed this jersey for your teammates, it must be bittersweet for you to contribute in that way, but not be able to go back and actually join them on the field.
Of course, I'm very, sometimes I feel very, very sad because I miss my country, of my teammate and all those activities in Afghanistan. But I'm feeling very proud that even though I'm away from Afghanistan, but I'm still involved in women's development and especially in sports and football in Afghanistan. And I can much more support women's football in Afghanistan from here, from Denmark, with the support of the company like Hummel and other organization who wants to help or support Afghanistan towards success and development.
Khalida, if there are listeners who want to get involved in some way, to donate, to contribute, or do something, what is a good way for them to get involved?
Well, with the new jerseys that which is launched yesterday, it is in the website of Hummel.net that we are actually planning to organize a festival or the women tournament that the women's national team of Afghanistan can travel to United States and play football in a tournament there in United States. So by buying this jersey, Hummel will donate 15 euros to this travel that the girls will take part, and it is kind of support for the team.
Oh, I'm definitely going to do that. It's a beautiful jersey, and it's such a great cause. So, Khalida, I wonder, you know, you have such a great message, and I want to give you the full platform here to get it out. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, at the moment, the message that I have that since yesterday, I can see that most of the media is focusing so much on the hijab, and there are so much talks about the hijab. I will say that designing this hijab, it doesn't like, we are not supporting any religion ideas or anything like political, but we want to by designing this hijab or supporting the women's national team down there, it is to give them opportunity to come and play football, and we want to increase the number of players by if they like to or if they want to or if they need to wear that hijab, so they are more welcome to wear and feel comfortable. It's not something about the religion or about anything. It's just giving an opportunity for women there.
That's wonderful. Khalida, listen, I want to just thank you for coming, making some time for us, coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
Okay, all right, guys. Kristen, we didn't warn you about this, but we do a thing called Tiki Talka at the end of every show where we talk okay. about something that sort of delighted us and that we want to share with everyone else. If you would like Bobby to go first, I know Bobby said he has something. It'll give you a little second to catch your breath and figure out what that is. And let's do it.
Yeah, guys, I never have something, but I saw, I'm reading through the news this week and I knew it right away. Sports Illustrated read an article on how Ali Bedoya and his wife ran into Ronaldo at the pool when they were vacationing somewhere. And apparently Ronaldo was seen, you know, walking in out of the, if you were walking in out of the hotel, you would see Ronaldo on the grass doing sit-ups, doing push-ups, swimming laps in the pool. And basically the point of the story was Bedoya's wife, who's a physiotherapist in Sweden, was like, if you want to be this good, you can never take a time off. And that just registered to me. I was like, maybe I don't want to be that good. You know, I think these guys who are that talented have a weird gene in their brain that most human beings don't want. They have character traits that people don't actually want to have. And if you think to yourself, if you don't want to ever have a vacation, then yeah, maybe you can be Ronaldo. But if you like a beer every now and then, if you like a brownie, and God, I love brownies, you can't do that. And it's as much as people want to be these incredible, heroic, athletic figures, you literally have to be born with a different personality trait, almost a genetic disorder, to have that willpower to do it.
Yeah, that sounds terrible to me. I would not want to be giving up my nights and weekends.
Sorry, I was just
I guess
having
maybe
a brownie.
I would if there were some guarantee that I could become a world famous soccer player, then maybe I would. But you know, I'm pretty happy with my life right now, and I'm like okay being mediocre at the things that I do, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And it seems like a lot of those top stars aren't that happy. They're always chasing so hard to be the best that they never get a piece of solace or happiness.
Okay.
But think of the money.
All right. Yeah.
And the
there's a lot of money. There's
well.
Like, you know, they're like bikini models and things like that, you know. Bobby, your life is pretty great, though, in Pennsylvania. So I don't know. You're kind of the Ronaldo of Pennsylvania.
I am, you know, and in Mechanicsburg, I can't even make that comparison, actually. It's kind of sad.
All right. Kristen, do you have anything for us here?
Remy Cabella, the French winger who is currently with Marseille, he went back to what was his first club, GFC Ajaccio, this evening. And he scored against them and didn't celebrate. And it was kind of beautiful. I don't know. I'm very torn on that idea of do you celebrate against former clubs? And I just genuinely felt when I looked at his face, he was quite upset to do it. Because again, they're a beautiful story, by the way. If you have the time, go and check it out. It is quite literally minnows fighting against giants with them in Liga in this season. And I just thought it was nice that kind of he was a little bit sad to score against the people who introduced him to football at a professional level.
That is nice. That is nice. All right. Okay. My Tiki Taka is kind of a cop-out, I apologize, but it's something that is important to me personally. My father is involved with this group called Love Football. We've given them a page of advertising in Howler before. We've tried to support them in certain ways. And this week, they are doing a fundraising campaign. What this organization does is they build safe places to play soccer for kids in Brazil. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, like, everyone plays soccer in Brazil. What's the problem? But there, it turns out that, you know, those stories you hear about, like, kids kicking rags and playing on, like, you know, syringe filled, like, dust bowl type, you know, garbage heaps is, I don't know, that might be overstating it, but there are plenty of dangerous places that these kids are playing. And what Love Football does is they just build these places that are sort of safe for them. And, you know, they're fenced in and they have, like, you know, there aren't like sharp sticks and stones and things on the field. And it's just a good organization that is really helping some kids who love soccer and want to play it and don't want to, you know, get hurt doing so. So they are having a fundraising campaign. They're also giving away a shirt signed by Pelé, another guy who my dad played against. I actually write about that in the new issue of Haller. That's about to come out. And you know, I typically don't involve family stuff or, you know, ask for money except for people to subscribe to Howler. But I really believe in this. It's, you know, we've donated. It's a great cause. And I would just encourage anyone who has, you know, 10 or 20 bucks lying around to go make a pledge. The URL is it's a kind of a complicated URL, razoo.com, razoo.com. This is the fundraising site. And I'm not going to give you the whole thing. It's like razoo.com/US/story/FruitQureshi give back to the game campaign. Anyway, don't go there. You won't find it. Just go to the show page at howlermagazine.com/podcast. Click on today's show and there will be a link. Very much appreciated if anyone who is inclined would donate.
That's going to do it for this episode of Howler. I would like to thank Kristen Hennage for telling us about Blackburn. Well, I guess really about Leicester City. And of course, Khalida Popel, because, man, she's so brave. And I'm just so glad that she's doing what she's doing. Go check out those jerseys that she helped design. Very good cause. Something you don't always see from the big sports retailers. Very glad that Hummel's doing that. I know I've asked for a few things in this episode. Check out my dad's Love Football campaign. It's a really good cause, and I would love to help him meet his goal. And also, of course, please check out the new issue of Howler, the cover at least. It's shipping from the printer next week. We waited longer than usual to release the cover, and I hope you like it. I hope you'll check it out. That's at shop.howlermagazine.com. Let's see. Of course, I got to thank Bobby. Got to thank the producers. Nick Jansen is a producer. Faisal Sikdar, and of course, we have Wes Burdine, Ryan Katniss. I was about to say his name, but he's no longer with us. Still on the team. Still team Howler, but Wes Burdine is the man now. What else? Oh yeah, you can follow Howler at What a Howler on Twitter and Instagram. That's where we put out the cover, and of course, Facebook.com/What a Howler. It would be great if you went and liked the show. I guess give it some stars and comments in iTunes. We don't say that very often, but it really helps people find it, and we're trying to grow the show's audience too. So you're a big part of that. You know, I think that sometimes people forget, hey, we're not this huge corporation. We can't just acquire a huge audience by putting an ad on another one of our shows. You know, we're building all this from scratch. And you guys, the thousands, you know, low thousands, four figures, people who listen to this show, subscribe to Howler, do all that stuff. You guys are right there with us, helping us push it forward. So I know it feels like you're the consumer sometimes, but really you guys are helping us make it happen. So anyway, that's enough of the spiel. I will leave you at that. Tell you next week, David Goldblatt will be back with us. He was available this week. It was a little too late in the day that he could do it. He's out on the West Coast. And so we said, hey, let's push it till next week. But we will be back with him and a whole host of dummies, Bobby included. And until then, remember that when you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.